This is Taking Aim, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking Aim starts right now.
Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us once again for another riveting episode of your favorite Saturday morning program, Taking Aim, exclusively right here on WEEB AM and FM in beautiful Moore County and beyond. I am Steve Woodward. My sidekick, my wingman, David Hensley, is away this week, so I will be solo in the saddle and try to do this without a safety net, and hopefully we'll get through it. We have a great lineup for you, and coming up later in the show, we will have a conversation with Reverend Alan Mashburn, who many of you will recognize as a former candidate for North Carolina Lieutenant Governor in an 11-person primary not too long ago. But Alan is also a very active conservative blogger and author and pastor of a Montgomery County church and the chairman of the Montgomery County Republican Party. So he'll be joining us just a little bit later as we look ahead to the upcoming state Republican convention as well as the 2026 election season. That'll be coming up. Well, you know, the judges and the courts can't get out of their own way these days in their efforts to thwart the ascendancy of the MAGA movement and President Donald Trump. It's getting to the point where not a day can go by without some development designed to thwart his policies and executive orders. This week, you have this obscure U.S. Court of International Trade, three-judge panel ruling that all of the tariffs that Trump has imposed or is imposing, and of course, with those go the negotiations toward a balanced global economy, all of those tariffs are now on hold because of this three-judge panel. They ruled against all the tariffs, against China, against Canada, EU, everybody. So now we just have to see where that goes. I think the Supreme Court will probably end up getting involved with that one, as it probably will with the latest move to derail DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, where we have this ridiculous attempt to convey all of the discoveries by DOGE as having violated the Constitution. Because in order to find out where all the waste, fraud, and abuse is, DOGE had to access government data systems and had to recommend the termination of all these federal employees who don't even come to work anymore, don't even show up at the office, and all of these ridiculous contracts with agencies like USAID, which were just pilfering away money all over the world. Anyway, this judge, Tanya Chutkan, has allowed a lawsuit by 14 attorneys general to go forward, alleging that DOGE and Elon Musk illegally exerted power over government operations. Now, we know that that effort was long overdue, and yet Tanya Chutkan has come to the rescue of the left. Now, who is she? Well, she's the one who engaged in all of the lawfare against Donald Trump, denying his claim of presidential unity and the immunity in the election interference case that that Jack Smith ran as a special counsel. You'll recall that case ultimately sent Peter Navarro and Steve Bannon, two Trump deputies, to prison, each for 4 months last year. So this is what we're up against with Tanya Chutkan. This is a story that we need to keep an eye on as Elon Musk now makes his transition back into private life, but leaving behind a very robust Department of Government Efficiency team to keep their eye on the billions of dollars, billions with a B, that is on autopilot is spent every year without any accountability and in many, many cases, quite fraudulently. There was a big breakthrough last week on a positive note, which I want to share with you and which I want to go over. Very important. Here we have the unthinkable, really. If you go back a couple of years, the Centers for Disease Control were seemingly ruling with an iron boot, and they, with Anthony Fauci and Francis Collins, mandated and fear-mongered their way to a demand for total compliance in terms of these mRNA jabs. I won't call them vaccines because technically they're not vaccines in the traditional sense, primarily because they were poorly trialed and untested and passed on an emergency use basis. But the CDC, amid the growing Make America Healthy Again movement and under the Trump era, announced in the past week that it would no longer recommend or include on its vaccine schedule the COVID-19 vaccine for healthy children and or healthy pregnant women. Now, many of us know that healthy children and healthy pregnant women have, in recent years, complied with, consented to receiving these jabs, again, to in response to media and CDC, Fauci fear-mongering. But with these jabs off the table for healthy children and healthy pregnant women, we are going to see a dramatic reversal of this trend whereby women are having difficult pregnancies who have received the vaccine, and healthy young athletes primarily literally being sidelined in their teen years or in their 20s and 30s by myocarditis, inflammation of the heart, in some cases fatally. But that safe and effective narrative is collapsing, and the CDC is merely acknowledging that. In fact, recently, Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson chaired a Senate hearing in Washington in which he brought forward a panel of individuals, researchers, scientists, and physicians who have, from the very beginning of the pandemic, warned against the reliance on these untested, potentially dangerous vaccines and the other policies that were jammed down our throat, like social distancing and wearing masks and locking down and all of those things that have now proven to be so out of the realm of common sense and in some cases very debilitating. One doctor in particular who made an impact during this hearing is Peter McCullough, a very well-known cardiologist and a person who has been banging the drum, warning us about the COVID jabs from the very beginning. Play clip one.
So for all the mothers in the room, how would they feel if they found their children dead after taking a COVID-19 vaccine? This is in the peer-reviewed literature. This is not misinformation. Everyone should be paying attention to this. This is not conjecture. This is in the peer-reviewed literature. So we started to ask ourselves, what is going on? Turns out that Pfizer and Moderna and Janssen are the genetic code for the spike protein. The spike protein is the damaging part of the virus. The spike protein is loaded into the body and it causes tremendous damage in some. Acute myocarditis appears to have some genetic predilection, and all of the vials of the vaccine are not the same. But I can tell you, I'm concerned that until the vaccines are stopped, there will be cases of acute myocarditis. And to finish, we've had 216 vaccine deaths this year alone. So if the vaccine campaign continues, we have to look at what are we getting out of it now, 4.5 years of the campaign, and how many more people will die. I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. Thank you for listening.
Did you hear what he said? 216 vaccine-related deaths in this year alone. Nobody talks about it. Certainly the media has no interest in it. And remember, many of these individuals who were vaccinated, so-called, did so in order to keep their jobs, in order to stay in the military, in order to be able to travel to attend the wedding of a loved one or the funeral of a loved one. So this is the final stages of this grim period of our history, and let's hope that it is never repeated, because we're basically subjected to criminal behavior by the CDC and its willful denying of the data. Blaze.com points out that at the height of the pandemic, only 2% of COVID cases required hospitalization. Yet polls show that Democrats believe the number was much higher, about 25%. It was a psychological operation that convinced Americans that the shot was the only way out, even though the jab carried a 4 times greater risk of harm than the virus itself. Let that sink in. Why don't you? We can look back on those days and now in retrospect, remember how ridiculous it was, and rightfully so. Some members of the comedy world saw an opportunity there. Play clip two.
Well, the vaccinators, you were real cocky a couple months ago. You got vaccinated. Got my second shot April 19th. I can't get sick from the corona. I'm vaccinated. See this bucket of virus? I'm vaccinated. I'll even lick metal. I'm not afraid of anything. I don't have to wear a mask.
People vaccinated are getting sick.
What? You need a new booster.
What?
Who wants a shot? Who wants to see a ball game?
Ooh, 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 ooh.
Ooh, 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 ooh. Wave your flipper. That's for you. Go see the ball game. Who wants to work again? That's for you. Who wants your kids educated? What's in the shot? It's safe. Don't worry.
That's pretty funny in retrospect. At the time, you know, if you had done a bit like that, you know, you might have been locked up with the with the January Sixers. Who knows? But that was comedian Jim Brewer. Had to share that one with you. Here's something else that will bring a smile to your face. You may have seen a poll in which President Trump's job approval rating exceeded the 50% threshold in the week that has just passed. That is largely unheard of for any president, especially over the long term. They tend to languish in the 40s and sometimes lower. That is the case with Republicans and Democrats alike. But there was a more, I think, more telling survey that came out from our friends at Rasmussen Reports, which is among the very few credible polling operations in the country, and its chief pollster, Mark Mitchell. Since 2006, Rasmussen Reports has been surveying on one very basic question. Is the country heading in the right direction, or is it on the wrong track? They call it right direction, wrong track. And historically, You see a very mixed bag there, because obviously we are a divided country ideologically. But in the past week, there was a day on which, for the first time since they started this survey, a strong percentage, 48%, said the country was heading in the right direction, while only 47% said wrong track. We have not seen right direction take the lead almost ever. And then, more tellingly, Rasmussen looked at the four-day rolling average and found out that the right track people, the right direction people, had an even stronger voice. Play clip three.
But in my opinion, right direction, wrong track is more of a report card for basically the democracy. It's an important number and something that a pollster should be laser focused on, because it means if the number goes up, that Americans are actually getting what they voted for. And surprise, over the last two decades of polling for Rasmussen's history, voters have not been getting what they've been voting for. And the number has been horrifyingly low for almost all of Obama's term. Right direction was essentially 30%. Joe Biden was kicking around in the high 20s and high 30s. All of a sudden, Trump 2.0 comes in and we're setting records right and left. And I saw something yesterday that I never thought I'd see in my polling career, is a 50% right direction print, which means, in layman's speak, that a majority of U.S. likely voters, for the very first time in Rasmussen polling history, think the country is headed in the right direction.
Wow. So, you know, the media, of course, spends 24/7 telling you that the Trump tariff strategy is going to destroy the economy, telling you that Elon Musk and Doge are going to take away your Social Security benefits and your Medicaid and Medicare. And yet, you know, what they overlook is that, you know, a vast majority of Americans, especially those of us aligned with the MAGA movement, are just not nearly as stupid as they would have us believe, as they think that we are. And I think that that data right there tells you that, you know, people sort of judge their day-to-day lives by how they feel. And despite all the fear-mongering about tariffs especially, we see price stability to a large degree. Now, and, you know, of course, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal say, yeah, but 6 months from now, it's going to be a bloodbath. Well, you know, let's see how that pans out. We see price stability in our day-to-day costs. Principally, the price of gasoline at the pump continues to trend downward. It's heck. I was even recently up north on Long Island, Nassau County. I couldn't believe the gas prices even up there in the, you know, eastern U.S. were well, for regular, were considerably below $3 a gallon. So it's even happening in the blue states. But we'll keep an eye on that, of course, as we always do. In the time we have remaining, you know, they always say that you know you're over the target when crazy stuff comes your way, when they start attacking, you know, sort of brutally and deliberately. Well, here's one that caught my attention. You're gonna love this. Now, many of you are familiar with the excellent work of an organization called Turning Point USA and its founder Charlie Kirk. In fact, we had one of his regional directors with us several weeks ago. Turning Point USA has, you know, massive presence that it has built up over a period of about 18 years on college campuses, liberating students to have the courage and the intellectual capacity, the training to go forward and promote conservative values among their classmates. And to expose the absurdity of the left on college campuses, the woke culture on their campuses, the diversity, equity, inclusion as essentially discrimination, because that's what it is. And Turning Point USA has even expanded, maybe more importantly, into the high school realm, because, of course, a lot of damage is done to young formative minds long before they get to college. So Turning Point USA is making a bold impact. And in fact, in the last election cycle, you could argue that some of their door-to-door work in these battleground states had a major impact in the outcome and essentially may have helped Donald Trump to win the White House. The Southern Poverty Law Center. Now, you've heard about them. They have a very sort of benign-sounding name, the Southern Poverty Law Center. Gee, they must be doing wonderful work. But what they like to do is target any conservative individuals or organizations that they find to be, you know, threatening to their leftist ideology. They have gone on the record as comparing Turning Point USA to the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, claiming that Turning Point USA is geared toward upholding white supremacy in the United States. And they have added TPUSA to their latest, what they call, hate map, characterizing the group as anti-government extremists and joining, among others, PragerU, another conservative platform that that reaches out to young people. And, of course, Turning Point USA is anything but a white supremacist, white nationalist organization. But the Southern Poverty Law Center, seeing the influence that Charlie Kirk is having, and we know that Kirk has been a presence in the Trump White House in an unofficial capacity, and they don't like that either. But in its latest report, A Year in Hate and Extremism, the Southern Poverty Law Center describes Turning Point USA as, quote, a well-funded, hard-right organization with links to hard-right extremists and tremendous amount of influence in conservative politics. Their primary strategy is to sow and exploit fear that white Christian supremacy is under attack by nefarious actors, including immigrants, the LGBTQ community, civil rights activists, and others. So beware the evil TPUSA and Charlie Kirk. Of course, all this does is reinforce the excellent work that Kirk and his legion of volunteers and supporters across the country are doing. It would be hilarious, other than the fact that previous organizations that have been targeted by Southern Poverty Law Center have come under attack by people who are not just using verbal weapons, but who, dare I say it, have ill intent for those who are involved. One example is Family Research Council. The same hate map that I cited was the trigger for a terrorist attack that could have led to a mass shooting had it not been thwarted against people involved with the Family Research Council, which is a pro-life organization. So this can be very dangerous, just as you had the tirade by Chuck Schumer against Supreme Court justices. And then what happens? The next thing you know, there's a guy caught outside of, I believe it was Neil Gorsuch's home, you know, with weapons and zip ties and all kinds of other equipment, as if he was preparing to go into a hostage situation. So we can laugh at this stuff, but it's also extremely dangerous. And we have to be vigilant about that. As we mentioned at the top of the show, we have a guest today joining us on Taking Aim. He is Alan Mashburn. Alan, good morning, and thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I am a Moore County native, so I feel like I'm home.
You are. You are home, and we're glad you joined us. Many of you will recall that Reverend Mashburn ran for lieutenant governor of the great state of North Carolina. But he's also very active on a number of other fronts. For one thing, I follow you on X, and I recommend that for those of you who use X, formerly known as Twitter. Also, Alan is an ambassador for the North Carolina Faith and Freedom Coalition, and a conservative author whose work you will find on a number of platforms, including Human Events Daily. Well, let's look ahead. You know, there's already starting to be forecasting going on in terms of 2026 and the upcoming elections at the state and federal level. Many of us, for many years, as Republicans here in North Carolina, have marveled at, or maybe we've grimaced at the iron-fisted reign of Phil Berger, the Senate president, and very much of, I guess you would call, a classic machine politician. He has finally, I think, poked the bear enough that he has inspired a candidate to run against him in the primary next year. That would be Sam Page, the longtime sheriff of Rockingham County. And Sam was one of your opponents in the lieutenant governor primary as well, when there were 11, I believe.
11, yes.
That was one short of a full basketball team. And but let's talk a little bit about Phil Berger and particularly with regard to his passion for casino gambling and the revenue that it generates. What, first of all, how do you see 2026 shaping up, and do you think that Sam Page can make a run at this entrenched politician?
Well, 2026 is certainly shaping up. If anyone can beat the Berger machine, it is Sam Page. Sheriff Page has been sheriff in Rockingham County for, I believe, 26, 27 years. He is very popular. He has been on the national scene. He's been to the border. He's served on the border council in the first Trump administration. He has stood with President Trump. President Trump knows him well. And he got quite a bit of votes. I mean, he got more votes than I did, and the majority of them came from his area. So that is an indicator that he is very popular. He is very well known. And if there's anyone that can take on the Berger machine, it's him. And I can tell you, if you're noticing social media, Phil Berger was almost non-existent on social media until Sam Page announced his intentions to run against him. And now he is put, I've never seen anyone put out endorsements this early. You know, the power of endorsements lasts about 30 minutes. And he has been putting them out daily. And I believe he's very well intentioned in what he's doing. Obviously, he's a machine in politics. But he's the man to beat. And he is certainly, he's scared. He's scared. And he should be. Because he's ruled this state with an iron fist. And, you know, I'm a nobody as far as I don't hold a political office, but I've been told if you go against this man, even as a private citizen, you're targeted by certain people. You know, it's almost like a mafia style, but that's what you get into in politics. It is what it is, but he needs to go.
Well, I believe we caught a glimpse of that here on the local level in Moore County. When not too long ago, our Senator Tom McGinnis suddenly was devoid of chairmanships on certain committees. And I think we can probably trace that back to Berger.
Oh, absolutely.
Berger's influence and not being pleased with something that was said or done.
Yeah, I mean, these guys play politics to the umpteenth degree. Once they get into power, they don't like to lose it, and they don't like anyone to go against them. I mean, it's their nature. It's the nature of the beast. And that's with Berger, that's with Schumer, that's, I mean, up and down the aisle of national and state politics. But, I mean, Senator McGinnis is a good friend of mine, and he's certainly, I believe, to be a good man. If he's been devoid of those chairmanships, which I have heard that he has, it's certainly because he has gone against the Berger machine.
Let's talk a little bit about the pending state budget scenario. Last time around, the delay in getting that budget passed was bordering on the absurd.
Yeah.
And, you know, the average person walking around doesn't really understand or doesn't care particularly when the budget is passed. It doesn't maybe affect them day to day. But when you talk about educational institutions that rely on the funding and state and local municipalities, you know, budget delays are delays in funding, essentially, that they rely on, that they've budgeted themselves at their, you know, in their internal budgets. That, of course, was largely owed to the fight for casino gambling the last time around, and then it seemed that Berger suddenly dropped his ambitions in that regard. But where do you see that going now with this new budget round of budget debates and the House budget having now been passed?
Well, let me expand on that. Let's go back, because a lot of people don't understand or remember or wasn't in tune when this was going on. The budget process 2 years ago was being held hostage by the Berger machine unless casinos got into it. And then finally he relented when he saw that he wasn't getting anywhere and that it was actually hurting Republicans and going to harm their reelection chances. And now we're hearing the undercurrent at the legislative branch in Raleigh that it's coming back around. Now, no budget is ever perfect. No one gets everything they want. But the House has passed a budget that is sensible. It's fiscally sound. It restores the rainy day fund. It rips millions of dollars from the DEI programs, which essentially that's the only way to get rid of it is to defund it.
Correct.
And to surgically remove it. It gives a raise to teachers. I mean, if you go line item on that thing, it is a dream. Western North Carolina is put as priority. And then all of a sudden now I'm hearing undercurrents at the General Assembly that, you know, if it goes this way, you know, I'm going to forecast, or I'm being told that this is being said at the General Assembly, we're going to forecast this budget's going to be a fiscal cliff and we're going to need extra revenue and this is going to bring in casinos or the need for casinos and the revenue from casinos. I am an ambassador for NC Faith and Freedom Coalition. We have not met about this, and I am not saying this on behalf of them. I want to make that very clear. But I do have a footprint with basically every other faith-based organization in this state. And I can tell you, if that comes back up, we're going to go full hellfire on this because we've had enough. We've had enough of one man wanting to strong arm us. We've had this. Go to Cherokee. Go to Murphy and see what they say about it. You know, and even on the Cherokee Reservation, where they do have casino gambling, they don't want the competition either. There's nothing we can do about that. They're on sovereign nation. But we do have a voice. We do have a chance here. And I know every one of your listeners is not going to feel the same way I do. But go and do your own research and see the areas that have casino gambling and see what goes along with that. I know pastors right outside of Cherokee who will come forth and tell me and testify that they have people, they have men and women, mainly men, fathers coming by their churches wanting money to pay their light bill because they have gambled away everything that they got paid on Friday evening. I mean, there's a whole myriad of things. Why does Phil Berger want this? Well, evidently, there's a political power at play. There's something in it for him. I can't defame him on public radio, but I can say this. A politician is going to be a politician. And there's always something there. And this is not good for our state. And one man doesn't have the power and should never have the power to forecast that for us, and I think we need to stop him. We need to get behind Sam Page. He's a good man, and we need to make sure that that a politician is retired and he has an opportunity to get an honest job if all he wants is to defy the will of the people, and then secondly, bring moral degradation to a society.
That is reason enough to get behind a Sam Page run next year in the primary. And now we will see, I guess, what is your forecast for reaching the budget finish line here? Is this going to be another prolonged ordeal?
I think you're going to see it. It probably going to be dragged out. You know, anything we say is simply a forecast because we're not in the committee rooms. But I see a repeat of 2 years ago, somewhat. But there's one thing I would say to Senator Berger. We have turned into a purple state in North Carolina. We've had all of these people move in. We're forecast to see another 1 million people move in within the next 5 to 10 years. We cannot risk the majority in the state house and the Senate based upon your frivolous promises to lobbyists or your friends. We cannot, and we won't. North Carolina is bigger than you and your desires and your whatever. What you promised to other people. And so I think that's the ultimate thing. You've got to look at the bigger picture. He's putting everything on the line. When he wants something that the majority of the legislative branch does not want, he's putting them in jeopardy. Josh Stein and Tricia Cawthon, I can say this because she said this publicly. I was speaking at an event last week with her. Representative Cawthon said that the governor said to her personally that he had $10 million set aside just to unseat her alone. We cannot go into 2026 having Josh Stein go against our Republicans and then our Republicans going against them to primary those who they don't agree with or whatever that were forced to do this. So we find ourselves in a conundrum. And yeah. So the best way to alleviate that is to tell Mr. Berger, thanks, but no thanks.
And then longer term, how is there a way for the Republicans to break the Democrats' stranglehold on the governor's mansion? I mean, the last time around, we clearly put ourselves at a decided disadvantage from the outset. And now I don't see anyone emerging in 28.
You know, we're in a good position right now with the Board of Elections. Everybody wants to say, you know, it wasn't fair since 2020. And I get it. I totally get it. I don't trust anything the government tells me. And they have created that, not me. But we're in a great position now with Dave Bolick and appointing, having a Republican majority there. So we want to see it fair. That's it. We just want to see it fair and honest. But like you said, someone has got to step up, and they should be stepping up right now. They've got to be well-funded. And if they're not well-funded, they've got to be able to raise money because it's going to take millions. And we have got to support that candidate, and we've got to vet that candidate. And I believe they need some recognition, some name recognition. You know, when I ran for lieutenant governor, I knew the flow was against me, but I had a reason for doing it. And that reason was to take a stand. And it's given me a platform that I would have never dreamed. But we need somebody to get in there with the goal of winning and to take a stand and to take back the governor's mansion. Is it possible? It is possible if that person comes forward within the next little while. And they have to be serious, they have to be well-funded, and they have to be recognizable.
Well, we'll be talking a lot about that because I have to say, as someone who moved to this area permanently a decade ago, expecting to live in a sort of a Republican nirvana, I've been sorely disappointed. Of course, where I came from, Northern Illinois, was certainly much more ideological wasteland, but still, it's been frustrating. Let's look ahead to the upcoming state Republican convention, first weekend of next month in Greensboro. One of the items for discussion, and this is going to sound like we're just diving into the weeds here, but it's actually worth paying attention to, the plan of organization for the state Republican Party has been essentially overhauled, revised, rewritten, however you want to put it, and it will be debated at the convention. Alan, tell us why this matters.
Well, it matters because, let's take a look at how do we get here. The older, the 2024 version of the plan of organization wasn't perfect. It is not perfect. Even Billy Miller, the parliamentarian who has done this for 27 years, said it needs to be rewritten. So a committee was formed, and they started doing it. What has happened is the final draft has come forth. It's found on the NCGOP website. It has sought to lower the membership of the executive committee. It's changed the censorship roles or abilities of county parties. It's limited that. Many county parties took the initiative several years ago of censuring Tom Tillis for abandoning the party platform. Many have done that repeatedly every year. My county did that last year. I am the chairman of that county. I consider that censure to be perpetual. So it's still in effect. But nevertheless, the plan of organization also seeks to limit the influence of affiliate groups like the GOP Men's Group, the GOP TARS Group, the Teenage Republicans, the Young Republicans, groups such as that. So, you know, we're going to see some back and forward at the GOP convention, as we do. I mean, that's what the convention's for, to do business. And I expect it to be very cordial, but I expect it to be very lively because people are going to speak their mind, and we may see a revision coming, but it won't be at the convention. But it'll be an up and down vote.
Well, you mentioned the power or the authority of a county party to censure a Republican. Mm-hmm. We have seen that here in Moore County with regard to Tom Tillis. We had a divided party on that several years ago at the convention when he was in fact censured. Now, of course, the latest Tillis escapades have included derailing the nomination of Ed Martin for U.S. Attorney in the District of Columbia, arguably the most powerful U.S. attorney role that there is in the country. Tillis took it upon himself to diminish Martin's qualifications for that role based on a number of hyped up things that he had to say about him. And then 2 weeks later, Tillis comes out bashing the Trump plan to lower the cost of prescription drugs in a Senate hearing. So he's at it again. And there's certainly, I know in Moore County, a strong desire among our local Republicans here to, just for the record, to be on record saying we would support censuring Tillis yet again. But to take that away from county parties or to diminish it seems to me to be a non-starter.
Well, it does diminish it some, and the verbiage says that it is for you can censure for opportunistic candidates, those who would switch from Democrat to Republican just to run. You can censure them, or you could censure the for party disloyalty, which Tom Tillis would still fall up under that if he abandoned the party platform. I don't want anything diminished from a county party. You know, the county party stands on the front line. We organize the precincts. We're the front line at the ballot box. And I'm not looking to take any ordinances or any commands from Raleigh on anything. So my stand on that, just based on that alone, you'll probably see me as a delegate vote no, because I want my full authority as a member of the party, outside of being chairman. I just want my full authority. So I would have to see a better clarification on that. I don't want to see anything taken away from our liberty. That's not what the Republican Party is all about. We're about liberty, all about it, and maintaining it and fighting for it. So Tom Tillis, that's a whole nother can of worms.
Yeah.
But he's still crying. He still has panic attacks, evidently, from January 6th,
mm-hmm.
Thought that he was going to die. You know, we have our military stand and get bullets fired at them and shrapnel from AEDs, and we have law enforcement that stand at ready to defend our laws every day, but yet Tom Tillis felt threatened. Boo-hoo. Grow up. Ed Martin was the guy that we needed in that, howbeit that day has passed now, thanks Tom Tillis, and Ed Martin is doing a fantastic job. Spoke to him the other night, and he's doing a fantastic job on being the pardon attorney.
Correct.
And I'm very, very pleased to see President Trump put him in that role.
Yeah, that's sort of a classic be careful what you wish for situation.
Exactly. We can almost thank Tom Tillis for that, but don't want to give him any credit.
Now, we talked about, who could primary Phil Berger, and we talked about how in the world we're going to manage to line up a candidate for governor in the future who can win. What are the odds that we can come up with a primary opponent for Tom Tillis next year?
You know, ironically, back in October of last year, I got three phone calls, two from congressmen, one former congressman, one sitting congressman, and one from a Washington publication asking if I was going to run. While I would love to beat him, I'm not the man for a number of reasons. It's going to take a lot of money.
Yeah.
And whoever does so needs to do that. There's two out on the scene right now that I've seen. Don Brown, he's very much favored in the MAGA world. Mm-hmm. And then Andy Nielsen, I'll let you do your own research on him. But Andy and I have not had the greatest relationship, and you can see some of that online. But, as a party chairman, if he came to Montgomery County, I'd welcome him. That's my job. That's my role. He's a candidate. So, Andy, if you're listening, you can come and speak for 3 minutes at Montgomery County. But Don Brown is running, and he's been endorsed by several notable people now. What I would say to both of these candidates, if you want to be viable, you've got to raise money. Mm-hmm. And we have 100 counties. I know this because I've been there. 15,000 miles in a matter of months of traveling this state. I've been in nearly every GOP office, and you have got to do the same thing. You have got to be out among the people. They've got to see your face. They've got to hear what you stand for. You cannot stop. Don't stop at all. I should not be able to look on social media and see you eating a meal. Eat on the go. We need you. If you're going to be strong, if you're going to be viable, if you're serious, get on the roll and let's go.
Yeah. Yeah, that is good advice. No question about that, because something's got to give. And, I think part of Tillis's attitude and his sort of swagger up in the swampland there is that he feels that there will be no one capable of raising the money to defeat him or challenge him. And I think he just sort of assumes that he's safe, and that's, dangerous.
Or it's going to be like my primary that I ran in, and you're going to see a ton of candidate slate on the slate, and he's going to get it by default.
Yeah.
And when that happens, he's going to get it. I mean, he's going to be the most recognizable name. And sad to say, I mean no harm by our good people, but we have an electorate that is uneducated on who to vote for. If they recognize a name, that's who they're going to pick, if they even vote in the primary. And it's an off year as far as not presidential. So we're going to have a struggle in getting people to the polls. They're not going to see and deem it as important. I see a lot of people saying, President Trump's in. Great. Whew, we can breathe. No, you can't. We've got to take back the House. We've got to maintain majorities.
In fact, I find myself increasingly frustrated in the sort of the afterglow of January 20th. You know, we've got activist judges you know, putting the brakes on everything that Trump is doing in terms of executive orders. Most recently, the sweeping court ruling to basically put all of his tariffs on hold, executive orders that have sought to rein in woke universities, et cetera, the courts are killing us. And it doesn't help that we have an attorney general like Jeff Jackson who joins into these attorney general lawsuits to hinder Trump, the progress of the MAGA movement. And then, of course, we have the endless assaults on by the media on everything that comes down the path. And yet, you know, people don't understand the tariffs. They don't understand the long game with those. The media will not tell us that prices on energy are coming down, that prices on groceries are coming down. And even now, it looks like the Senate is going to have a hard time with this big, beautiful bill. So to your point, vigilance is necessary. We can't stop.
Absolutely. You know, Matt Van Swall, if you follow him on X, he is very well known. Great friend of mine, lives in Western North Carolina. Right. He and I and others have been hammering, you've got to get codify the Doge cuts.
Yeah.
And now, all of a sudden, we're hearing now that a rescissions bill is going back, going to Congress next week. So, listen, what you do matters. If you get out and speak up, they hear you, they listen, they have to hammer those phones, hammer those emails. It's your republic if you can keep it.
If we don't start taking big chunks out of this federal debt, and we've got plenty of targets to do it, thanks to Elon Musk and Doge, you know, this is not a sustainable forecast for our country economically.
It has to be done, and I mean it has to be done this calendar year. Yeah. If it's not done this calendar year, it won't get done. And if it's not done at all, America's gone.
Reverend Alan Mashburn, I want to thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to speak with you on these various topics. Make sure to follow Alan Mashburn on X and his other writings at platforms such as Human Events Daily, and follow his work as well with the North Carolina Faith and Freedom Coalition. Alan, thanks again. We'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Been an honor. Thank you.
Hey, time is running short on another riveting episode of your favorite Saturday show. We want to thank all of you for joining us, and we'll be here next week, 11 a.m. on Saturdays. David Hensley should be back. I'm Steve Woodward. We'll see you next time.